I guess in some ways, like, it would be impossible for Connolly to kind of understand the question of racialization. That language doesn't enter into, like, the Marxist lexicon for decades still. The language of, it was, I guess in some ways, they saw the world through the sectarian lens of, like, Catholic versus Protestant, which is kind of racialization, but different. There is the whole thing of, like, Irish people are, like, the N-words of the North. And then there's, like, the thesis of, like, what's that book, How the Irish Became White? Can you go a little bit of the argument of that book?
So Noel Ignatieff wrote the book, and I actually shamefully haven't read it, but I've heard the argument summarized in a number of different contexts, is this idea that the Irish diaspora, I assume he's concentrating primarily on the United States, after coming from this kind of, you know, anti-imperialist and rabble-rousing trade union sentiment, managed to become one of the primary pillars of, you know, reaction within the Great Satan, right? Like, become integrated into the Democratic Party machine in New York, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, the role that they play. I mean, this happened recently. The leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald, now went over to this conference of very wealthy Americans to talk about how the Irish independence struggle is getting on. Gerry Adams going to gala dinners that, you know, $500, $1,000 for a ticket. And, you know, what it means to... Rolston and McVeigh frame it in terms of white dominion, and that dominion status provides this kind of, you know, ideological way of wedding these people into reactionary projects. And the movement of dominion into the Free State, into the six counties after the partitions, into the United States then, is kind of making sure that anti-imperialist history or sentiment or heritage is kind of drowned out. And it's really depressing to look back over Connolly's time in the United States, because, as I said, he's kind of going back and forth over to the US for much of his life. He gets, I just have some exact statistics here. He gets involved with the American labor movement, like Daniel DeLone and the Socialist Labor Party at the time, and as well the IWW. And he would be extremely useful to them because of his understanding of the Irish question, his capacity to mobilize Irish workers. He learned German and Italian in order to more effectively organize workers in New Jersey.
Yeah, apparently he worked at the Singer factory, and there was like 9,000 workers there, or 10,000, something like that. Like, just mind-blowing amount of, like, human life. Such in one factory setting.
The thousands of people he manages to mobilize is just defies imagination at this kind of point in history. I mean, you kind of, those kind of workplaces where you would get, you know, and cities and cities worth of people just in one place. So, you know, I won't be conveying the exact chronology of kind of his movements back and forth to the United States, but you see this again in 1910 when he gets into contact with a trade union organizer named Jim Larkin, who had been kicked out of the National Union of Dock Laborers in Belfast because he was regarded as being too militant. So he forms a breakaway union. And again, like, how many times in history are breakaway unions just absolute roads to nowhere? But this guy manages to set up the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, or the ITGWU, in 1909. Connolly comes on as an organizer for this union. And when he moves to Belfast, it has 5,000 members. You know, Larkin becomes kind of an important figure in Connolly's life. They're kind of very different people in a lot of ways. Connolly is kind of more reliable and staid and thinks things through. He's tactical. He can manage money. Larkin is immensely skilled, like Connolly is an organizational force of nature, but really alienates people, can't really hold on to money. And this is the context in which...
Kind of like Marx and Engels.
Kind of like Marx and Engels. My God.
Everyone, I never thought about it. I'm looking for my Engels. Engels, if you're out there, come to see me, okay? I need you to support me. I need you to support my Engels. Damn. Brown Engels. Brangles.
That's so good. Okay, sorry, I'm just trying to recover from the fact that I'm just completely seeing this in a whole new way. Okay, so... This is the context in which the lockout happens. The stage is set, but I just kind of need to hop back into kind of parliamentary developments and how Home Rule is developing. So in 1910, John Redmond announces that Home Rule has been put before the Liberal Prime Minister, who is a member of the Liberal Party, and his name is Herbert Asquith. So word is out that home rule is on the cards. So the barrister Edward Carson and James Craig, who is a politician from Belfast who had inherited his father's enormous distilling fortune, starts to speak at meetings of the Orange Lodges. The Orange Order was and is a counter-revolutionary loyalist organization established in order to celebrate particular moments in which the Anglican Protestant establishment secured victories over Irish separatism. And Carson and Craig are talking about how Ulster and Ulster Unionists are going to oppose the implementation of Home Rule by any and all means. And it's important to note here that, you know, we don't want to project kind of our history backwards. The six counties, you know, and the nine county broader actual historical province of Ulster were not as a majority in favor of independence. This was a campaign that was waged by reactionary pro-British elements within Ireland. They also had support from the British, who supplied them with arms, and ex-British army officers helped to train up these anti-home rule militias that are beginning to crop up. And this is all
moderate rebels. These are moderate rebels, folks.
Totally, totally. And this is all drawing up on old ideas of papist descent, conspiratorial Catholics, and there's this new kind of sectarian. Well, I don't know how new it is. Someone was accusing me of overemphasizing the degree to which this is a novel thing at this stage, but take that for what it's worth. You begin to get Catholics being chased off shipyards, beaten up by Protestant workers. So you get this, the Protestant working class are beginning to throw its lot in with this loyalist aristocracy, because many of the Catholics that they're chasing off the yards are the shop stewards. They're the most developed workers and they're the most skilled organizers. Connolly is trying to swim against the tide of this. He's setting up non-sectarian marching bands and trying to raise morale for strike funds to just counter some of this atmosphere and get the solidarity back in there. On the 28th of September 1912, Carson leads thousands of unionists to sign something called a Solemn League and Covenant, which pledges all signatories to resist the imposition of home rule. In many cases, landlords and employers are bringing this pledge to their employees and to their tenants, you know, more or less forced to sign. So that's just underlined that at the root of the social circumstances that were ultimately to lead to the partition of Ireland was always a minoritarian kind of tyranny. It becomes impossible for Connolly to hold open-air union meetings anywhere except Catholic areas in Belfast at this stage. So the Irish Republican Brotherhood are starting to discuss the formation of a revolutionary army, the Volunteers, to compete with this unionist threat. About six months after they've started to recruit, they have 100,000 members, and they've gotten their hands on 900 rifles, which were shipped in at Howth, which is a fishing village, which is north of Dublin. And in sort of a revenge attack for the success of this shipment, the British shoot three people on the quays of the Liffey. And this is further recruitment potential for the Volunteers. They have nearly 191,000 members by September. Just so I'm absolutely clear on this, the IRB were the small clandestine organization, while the Volunteers were this much, much larger rank and file thing. They had nearly 191,000 members by September, as I said. And the IRB's capacity to control the Volunteers was often quite limited. They had leaders like Owen McNeill who were leading the Volunteers but were not in the IRB, and they had principled opposition. You know, they were moderates. They were more radical than Redmond in the sense that they were setting up a private army that was outside of his control. Or not a private army, but an army that he didn't strictly have control over. But they didn't necessarily want to take radical action against the British Empire in the same way many members of the IRB would have wanted to.
The violence question rears its ugly head again.
Absolutely. And
a textbook of anti-colonial debates. And
you can see the split coming, you know, a million miles down the road. Well, Redmond makes his play. The leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party is not thrilled by not controlling this army, and he demanded 23 of his appointees be placed on the Volunteers Committee. And the IRB agreed to this so as to prevent a split in the movement. So the 1913 lockout, I'm sorry, I'm just feel like I'm kind of talking at you like it's an audiobook or something. So cut me off at any point if you want to.
Most people don't know this stuff. That's the thing. Like most people, like I don't know, I have to pause here, but like the sad reality is that like you say Irish, like anything, like maybe there's people who are like, oh, IRA. And like, it's kind of like a cipher for anti-British imperialism or something like that. Like, but I don't know. I feel that like all of that has been dwarfed by the reality of like you know, if you're dealing, if like the Irishness that's like celebrated here is just like drunken buffoonery and fighting like once a year on a day, you know what I mean? And it's like, that's this, it's such a shame. And then, I mean, I brought this up in my interview with Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, like the, that like, you know, fucking, what's his name? That horrible MMA guy, Conor McGregor, like this is like, that's kind of like a specter of Irish working class something. I don't know, like sentiment or something, just, you know, purely celebrated around alcohol and violence and fighting and chauvinism. And especially for him, Islamophobia. I don't know. It's a depressing thought to think that, like what's like the sad reality of like all this radical history, you know, for what it is. I mean, whatever it may be, but like for all this radical history, that at the end of the day, it's like, you know, Boston cops screaming at some parade once a year. Like, come on, that's like the remnants of Irishness. But that's Irish Americanness, to be real. Like, that's anything American, quite frankly. America will do that to you. It'll turn you into a reactionary. So Cubans have the same problem. Iranians have the same problem. That like the reactionaries end up representing you, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And it's such a, and so I guess in this way, it's good to like reclaim figures.
Yeah,
like
no, totally. And like Connor. The fortunate thing for me, at least, is that that is very much an Irish American thing. And someone like Conor McGregor would very much be a friend of mine refers to it as kind of Yank brained, you know, like he's detached himself from Ireland and Irishness in many ways. And this is actually to come back to kind of a better way of defining that term you asked me about before, which is dominion, which refers to the way in which post-colonial statehood is like, its limits as a political and economic project is determined by the imperialists. And both in terms of affiliation or borders or even the capacity you have to develop, you know, as a, industrially is all dictated by the former quote unquote, imperialist colony. Employers in Dublin are looking at Larkin and Connolly's activity up in Belfast, and they're getting increasingly worried because they think that this new model of industrial organizing that Larkin seems to have brought to Ireland might catch on here. So they form an employers association under the control of William Martin Murphy, who is a newspaper owner, a hotelier, a man in command of an enormous amount of capital both in Ireland and in Latin America, actually. And he goes on the offensive and sets out to break the ITGWU in Dublin definitively. He forces a pledge on his workers in the newspaper dispatch office that they'll renounce the union. 60 of them refuse and they're sacked. The next Thursday, he forces a demand on his tram drivers and a sympathetic strike kicks off as tram workers walk off their trams, and Larkin leads enormous outdoor meetings every evening at a custom house, which is on the quays. Murphy goes up to Dublin Castle, which is the administrative centre of British rule in Ireland, and he is assured that the state will be on his side, and if push comes to shove against the workers, and police are brought in from Cork, which is a city on the south coast of Ireland. Scuffles are breaking out between police and working class parts of the city, and the police attack and kill two people. Larkin is arrested, but then he's let out on bail. The Dublin Metropolitan Police publish a proclamation warning that a protest planned for O'Connell Street would be illegal, and Larkin burns a copy of this order outside Liberty Hall, which is the ITGUW headquarters. Connolly is arrested. He refuses to commit to good behaviour, to agree to, you know, stepping down his campaign, and he's sentenced to 3 months for sedition. He goes on hunger strike, and this is just by the by, but you know, whenever you hear about Terence McSweeney or Bobby Sands, it's often talked about in terms of ancient Celtic practices.
I am a political prisoner because I am a casualty of a perennial war that is being fought between the oppressed Irish people and an alien, unwanted regime that refuses to withdraw from our land.
Bobby Sands, who was serving a 14-year prison term on a weapons possession charge, had been demanding special status as a political prisoner. A number of other Irish Republican Army members have joined Sands in his protest and are also well into a hunger strike.
This was drama at the absolute rawest edge that it could possibly be.
You couldn't ask for a more hostile environment. Bobby Sands is putting on a performance for the world, for his cause. That is the cause that has murdered people.
We are not prepared to give in to blackmail in the form of a hunger strike or of any other form of pressure.
I declare that Bobby Sands has been duly elected to serve as a member for the third constituency.
Sands was trying to be the author of his own destiny.
It is not those who can inflict the most, but those who can suffer the most who will win.
Now as I write, my thoughts return to the days of my youth. They will not criminalize us, rob us of our true identity.
I saw in this man more determination than I've ever seen in any person before.
I'm standing on the threshold of another trembling world. May God have mercy on my soul.
You know, like taking a hunger on you and sitting outside their door. But I think that this actually, the suffragettes had kind of done it just kind of before in British prisons. And Connolly would have been very supportive of the broader democratic movement, and he would have always called for women's rights. I just thought that was an interesting connection. But yeah, I think he's the first, you know, Republican male hunger striker in a modern context. Although someone's probably going to tell me I'm wrong and that was a 19th century one. So the question was, what would Larkin do? Would he show up on O'Connell Street? Would he risk arrest? Or would he back down? And what he does is he goes in disguise to the Imperial Hotel, which is owned by William Martin Murphy. He books a room which looks out over O'Connell Street, and he begins addressing the crowd out the window. He's arrested. The police, in a drunken frenzy, go mental on the crowd that are gathered there. They injure hundreds of people. And then they go up into the tenements, the working class slums, and they attack people in their homes, smash up their belongings. And this is the first of four Bloody Sundays that the British have inflicted on Ireland. And at this stage, the lockout kind of begins in earnest. 400 capitalists lock 20,000 workers out of their jobs for 6 months. Larkin is charged, but he wasn't granted bail this time. So all through this, and I'm going to try to not get too bogged down in the detail, tens of thousands of workers are marching at funeral processions for people who are being killed by Crown forces. They start to agitate for Connolly's release because the magistrate is found to be a shareholder in Murphy's tram company. His release is then secured. And radical socialist newspapers, both in Ireland and in England, are urging the British trade unions to expand the strike. The representatives of the British labour movement are moving back and forth during this entire process. While they're making sympathetic noises and they're delivering aid, they're presenting themselves as mediators, their primary objective is to ensure that the strike does not spread to England at all under any circumstances. And this is often against the wishes of their workers. There were consistent small donations coming into Dublin from the centre of British industry that could not have been anything other than shows of solidarity from the British proletariat. But the leaders are obviously significantly less keen. So in order to avoid starvation during this whole process, Larkin's sister Delia and Constance Markievicz, who I've mentioned already, are feeding starving people at Liberty Hall. And in mid-October, a group of suffragettes proposed taking children from Dublin to England in order to save them from going hungry during all this. Similar schemes had taken place during strikes in the past. So, you know, the leadership didn't really think about it. This just seemed like something that might happen. But this gave the clergy the opportunity to weigh in and said that this was a Protestant plot to convert Catholic children to Protestantism. A certificate of Orange Order membership belonging to A. Jim Larkin, which is not an uncommon name, was printed in the papers. And priests lead people down to the quays where there were riots during which loads of people were injured. So Connolly, in an absolutely genius move, cancels the free dinners being handed out in Liberty Hall and tells the church they can attend to feeding the starving population. Their charitable organizations are, of course, totally overwhelmed. The Archbishop backs down and Liberty Hall starts feeding people again. So scab labor starts being brought in. They have the run of the city. They are often armed. They have the protection of Crown forces. A 16-year-old girl is shot and killed by one of the scabs who are kind of jeering at them for being scabs. So the Irish Citizen Army arises out of this situation where Connolly realizes there's a need to have an armed contingent of workers that can defend them. So they don't have rifles, which is a small problem. So they drill with hurleys, which is a stick used in a stick and ball game called hurling. And they have little kind of metal bits shoot onto their heel. So, you know, they're formidable yokes in a pinch. So this whole time, as I said, the Brits are delaying. They don't want to lend full support, but the British Trade Union Congress eventually grant a meeting at which a course of action on which the lockout would be decided on the 9th of December. And the 2 weeks leading up to it, Connolly and Larkin go up and down Britain. They hold a mass meeting in this, in an English city every day, calling for further escalation, appealing for support. But the right wing within British Labour was also organising. And the day of the Congress, they bait Larkin. Larkin stands up and denounces them for 15 minutes, calling them all unelected, demanding that the sympathetic strike be initiated. Supporters of the lockout were heckled, and the only thing they get is a meaningless resolution. You know, step by step, the workers start going back to work. The position of the strike is just undermined. And because the British trade unions failed to black goods on the scale that was needed in order to build it forward. Desmond Greaves, one of Connolly's biographers, puts it, I think, really perfectly. And in the context of kind of the war that's just about to be declared, in which the British trade unions again played this apparent role. Once more, British democracy suffered defeat because it failed to extend its full solidarity to the people of an oppressed nation. So it's a crucible of the Irish labour movement. But Connolly comes out of the lockout pretty optimistic. He thought that it had been fought to a draw, and he was left in charge of the Citizen Army, which did not disband. Larkin went to the United States to recuperate, and Connolly is left in charge of the ITGWU. Okay, that's the lockout. Okay, please ask me a question so I don't totally feel like I'm boring you here.
Okay, so the thing about the historiography of the lockout versus the Easter Rising is that, like, because of the culmination of the Easter Rising in Connolly's death and execution, like this is kind of like the secondary incident, or like the incident that leads to the causality chain is one way, right? Like, that's kind of how we think of it. But like, how much does the lockout set the stage for what happens next? Or does the lockout show what's going to happen in the Easter? Like, does the deciding things show, is like the real story inside the lockout, or is it in the Easter Rising?
I think it's kind of both, because as we'll kind of get on to see, like, in the period of, I can't really talk about this unless I give a bigger, broader context. Yeah, so I think it's both, because all through this time when we're into the road to the Rising, right? The war is declared. There's this new widespread awareness that among both Connolly and the IRB, independently, of course, that now is the time that they have to strike. But over the 2 to 3 years that they have in terms of that, you know, in terms of that interstitial phase, Connolly is constantly agitating, organizing, back and forth to Belfast. In the year before the Rising, he wins a wage increase for every section of the union that the ITGWU represents. He goes to remote parts of the country to set up branches. And, you know, this is just an example of how they kind of came together. In Kerry, in particular, on the West Coast. And that's important because that's a good place you could, in theory, land any weapons that you might want to bring in. So we can kind of come on to the broader political context. In 1914, Asquith declares that any county within Ireland where there's a majority of electors who are against home rule, they could opt out. So he's laying the foundation for partition. All Ireland democracy no longer counts. A signal to the unionists, to Carson, that you can gerrymander particular areas and you can hold on to them within the empire. Connolly and Larkin call on the British Labour Party to raise this and to try and put an end to it, and the response was totally negative, just by the by. So Connolly gets in touch with Tom Clark, Eamon Cant and Sean McDermott, who are the three men on the IRB committee with the most influence. And he began to join with them in kind of an anti-recruitment campaign. And this is particularly important because Redmond had split the Irish volunteers first by saying that Asquith could remove British soldiers from Ireland. The British could take whoever they had stationed there out and send them to the front because he could depend on Irish people remaining loyal to the British Empire, and then telling Irish people to sign up to fight for England. 90% of the volunteers do go, but a more militant cadre remain, and they begin to drill and practice with the citizen army with real rifles this time. And of course, all the familiar smears you get that Connolly was a German agent start to come out. As I mentioned, the British trade unions kind of fail their workers completely by contributing to this air of jingoism that's engulfing the European social democracy. Some workers are quoting Connolly to their executive committees, but you know, they're just not decisive, or they're not powerful enough to have an influence. So the IRB are planning some form of insurrection on the basis that England is distracted, now is a good time to strike. And Connolly attends a meeting with their leaders, who I've already mentioned, as well as Padraig Pearse, John McBride, Tomás McDonagh, and Roger Casement, who people may have heard of. He was a diplomat who brought to light the horror of the Belgians' abuse of the Congolese people, as well as the rubber trade in Peru. He sent to Germany to secure military assistance in the form of guns. As I said, Connolly's a force of nature here. He's putting out pamphlets. He's writing essays on the 1905 Russian Revolution, spreading awareness of general military tactics. He's staying one step ahead of the censors. If they manage to smash up one of his printers, he gets another one, puts out his newspaper, his leaflet, whatever he has to do. And so there's always this contradiction between, in this alliance between the IRB and Connolly. He wants a mass politics and popular agitation that can bleed into strikes. He's appealing to rank and file volunteers over the head of their leaders, particularly McNeil, who I've mentioned, but as well as the IRB, who are just more interested in keeping it clandestine and keeping it secret. But he's eventually brought into the inner circle. Whether he's recruited or not, we don't know. He disappears for 3 days, but Liberty Hall is being used to store guns, ammunition, and to manufacture explosives. That's sorted. Because actually, they were worried that Connolly would take out the Irish Citizen Army independently, that he would do it prematurely without their being involved. So it kind of became a necessity. The IRB begin to make a play for control over the volunteers. Joseph Plunkett falsifies a warrant that calls for Owen McNeil's arrest. I know I'm throwing a lot of names, but remember, he was the conciliationist head of the volunteers, in order to make him realize that you had to have an armed strike against the British now. But McNeil sees through it, and he sends out a countermanding order against any mobilization for the date of the rising, which is fixed to be on April 23rd. McNeil sends out a letter saying, no one go out. And this order goes far and wide, and McNeil even managed to get it into the papers. So all across the country, people have destroyed their uniforms, they've destroyed their weapons, and the IRB are asking themselves what they're going to do. Tom Clark remains in favor of the original date, but the rest of them say we have to go out the following day. And as someone was saying to me there as well, the British had some awareness that a rising of some sort was going to happen. So the task of striking now was just particularly urgent. They try to get messengers out to say, you know, the countermanding order is false. We're going out the next day. But as I said, a lot of the equipment had already been destroyed. The efforts that did happen were sort of desultory. So talking about the rising in military terms, the original plan was to form a circle around the forecourts and send out lines to connect with the forces that were coming from everywhere. This was reasonably sound, but Casement, who was coming from Germany with guns, was intercepted by the British Navy. He's arrested, and so you have even more reduced numbers and even more reduced guns. I couldn't find the exact number of people who actually went out on the rising. I don't know if you had better luck. But one book I have says 920, another book says 1,200. We'll say it's something between those two figures. I would go through all the positions, but I'll just say there's a website called The City and the Rising, which is a great website to check out if you want to see detailed maps and the positions and the 3D models where all the main garrisons are. For our purposes here, I'll just say 70 soldiers, four members of the IRB, and Connolly are in the General Post Office on O'Connell Street, which is this big neoclassical building which kind of commands a position over that whole street. 70 soldiers force the civilians out of the GPO. They build barricades, they unload sandbags, smash the windows, raise the tricolour over the roof, and a green flag which says Irish Republic, which Markievicz had painted. Although another source said it said Poblach na hÉireann in Irish. So, you know, it's kind of a Schrodinger's Irish Republic, I guess. The Starry Plough, which is the icon of the Citizen Army, flies over a hotel across the road, which is, of course, owned by William Martin Murphy. Pearse reads the proclamation, declares the Provisional Government of the Irish Republic to a bemused crowd, and a number of Lancers who come to investigate are repelled with rifle fire. The new military strategy was to extend the circle they had developed in the hope that more volunteers would realize the fight was on and join in. But, you know, very soon it becomes clear, look, this is just a failed, this is going to fail. And Connolly spends most of his time writing statements intended to keep everyone's spirits up, which Winifred Kearney, a suffragist and trade unionist, delivered to the other garrisons. They were often far more optimistic than the reality of their situation, and Connolly knew this. So the British start to bombard Liberty Hall, convinced that this is the centre of the rebellion. In fact, it was empty. And on Wednesday, the gunship Helga is sent up the Liffey and starts to bombard the Metropole Hotel in order to open up a line of sight to the GPO. Connolly catches a bullet in the arm. He asks a medical student in the GPO to patch it up, but not to spread news around in case it damages morale. He sees an expedition across the bridge to Liffey Street, and he catches another bullet which shatters his ankle. He passes out from the pain, manages to drag himself back to the GPO, where a surgeon puts his ankle into a splint. He gives him enough painkillers that he can sleep, and when he wakes up, he requests that he be put on a bed with wheels so that he can resume his command. And in his last dispatch, Pierce reported that he remained the brains of the operation. By Thursday, much of O'Connell Street was on fire. They were surrounded, the roof was on the brink of collapse, so they evacuated by Henry Street and then Moore Street, led by a man named the O'Rahilly. I say that just in order to spread broader awareness of the name, the O'Rahilly, which is just the greatest name of all time. He led them. He catches the brunt of the machine gun fire coming up Moore Street, sloped into a doorway, wrote a letter to his wife, and dies. All the women were evacuated at the GPO, with the exception of Elizabeth O'Farrell, Winifred Kearney, who both refused to leave Connolly, as well as one other woman whose name I unfortunately cannot find. Thomas Clark was once again the more militant voice in the room, favoured fighting on, but Connolly's wound was becoming gangrenous. The rest of them saw how unlikely victory was, that it was just going to lead to more killing. Elizabeth O'Farrell goes out with a white flag, very bravely, because three men with white flags had already been shot, and a surrender document was issued, signed by Pearson Connolly, in order to ensure the other garrisons would step down. Is that the longest uninterrupted speech has anyone had in East is a Podcast history? I think so.
This is an extremist podcast. We'll go from me interrupting the person every 5 seconds to me not speaking for 10 minutes. No, this is the best. No, this is such a, this is like a thrilling, like this is romantic nationalism in action. Like the best kind, you know, like fighting against empires, like struggling. I mean, I know I'm romanticizing this guy's death and failure of this movement and like crushing of a movement. I know, but like, I don't know. That's like from this distance, 100 years ago. Like 100 years later, it's such like a, I don't know, it's mixed feelings. It's also sad because of like how, like what I know of like modern Ireland, just like a normal, regular, boring country in the EU. Like, you know, it's kind of like, this is something I brought up in my conversation with Mick and Claire. It's like the, is it like the end game of all these struggles of all these years of struggle, of like centuries of struggle and like resistance to British Empire, ended up in like joining the EU, like, you know, like having Ryanair. like, I don't know. I feel like, how do you assess history from like a national perspective when like the characters are so grand, like Colin Connolly?
Well,
like
it would come back to that thing I said about kind of Conor McGregor very much not having a lot to do with the Irish working class as it currently exists. That consciousness and that identification with the leaders of the rising, and that kind of message of, as the proclamation says, and I know people try to read it in terms of talking about Catholic and Protestant, cherishing all children of the nations equally, cherishing all children of the nation equally. You know, it's difficult to read Connolly's participation in that, and as an anti-imperialist gesture, as anything other than tending towards kind of social equality. And if you look at kind of working class areas in Dublin on the north side or in the western side of the city, you'll see that all the streets are named after these revolutionaries, are named after Connolly. You have boxing clubs where they have murals with Connolly's face on it. You know, this isn't an accident, but sadly the forces of North American capital, of European capital, are such that people can really start to identify with that. You know, this is dominion. This is why a partition state is not the state that was envisioned. This is not the republic that was declared. You know, they screwed us.
Yeah, yeah, they did. Like they, yeah, like this is betrayal. But betrayal suggests that they were not betrayed to begin with. That there was a point there wasn't a betrayal. Because the interests of the English obviously don't coincide with the interests of the Irish. They want a fractured enemy. Like, why let your neighbors get powerful when you can just keep them weak and divided?
Yeah, for sure. And that's the divide and rule tactic is absolutely absolutely what the logic of partition was supposed to. Lies at the heart of partition as a political project. I'll wrap up the execution. Maybe we can talk a little bit about his legacy for today, or kind of bring this into a close, because I'm running up on an hour and a half. I know that's your approximate running time usually. So
that's fine. It's fine. We can do this in two episodes. Perfect. It's okay. Part one, part two.
I'll talk about the execution. So it was only on Thursday that the uprising starts to actually be reported. And it was reported as being this communistic or Larkinist plot. Martin Murphy called specifically for Connolly to be executed. Clark, Pierce, and McDonough were shot on the 3rd of May, which was cheered on by all the bourgeois press. Plunkett, Edward Daly, and Michael O'Hanrahan the following day. I know these are a lot of names that I haven't gotten into, but I can't cover the entire biography of the IRB Central Committee. McBride, Mallon, Houston, Colbert, Kent. This was all spaced out over days. And apparently the original plan that the Brits had was to shoot 90 people. But at this stage, dissenting voices begin to emerge. Nationalist MPs begin to accuse Redmondites who supported the terror of being murderers. George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, speaks out against it and said, "No Irishman who takes up arms against the British can be a traitor." Connolly is court-martialed in bed while his wounds were being treated. He was found guilty of sedition, and his nurse describes how he remained calm and composed throughout, and he said to his prosecutors, "You can shoot me if you like, but I am dying for my country." His wife and his daughter Nora were brought into him in Dublin Castle, and I very much recommend that everyone listening to this type Nora Connolly into YouTube and watch the 30 minutes or so during which she describes her father, his life, making breakfast for the volunteers on the day itself, and the last few hours of his life as she witnessed them.
We were waking up, and it was about 1 o'clock at night, and the message that was given was that the prisoner, James Connolly, wanted to see his wife and eldest daughter. And Mama, Evan, it jumped to my mind immediately, you know, all had been executed up to then except himself, and Sean McDowell was immediately jumped to my mind that he was going to be executed. But Mama had the idea that he wasn't well, that it had taken a turn for the worse. Anyway, we got ready and we went down. We were taken in an army lorry right through Dublin. It was an awfully queer, eerie trip, because we were staying in William O'Brien's house at that time, coming down through O'Connell Street, and all the... still smelled burning, you know. They still got that horrible smell of burning, and not a soul on the streets, because there was curfew, you know, at that time. And you went through the dimly lit streets, and not a soul. You didn't even see a soldier until we came to the bridge. There was some there, and we went up to the castle. I don't think I told you in the first visit, but every time we went there, we were searched. Well, to see that we didn't bring anything in to help mend his life or something like that. But the last time we went up there, the nurse said, "I'm supposed to search you." But she said, "You give me your word, you have nothing that he can do away with himself with," he said, "and I won't search you." So Mama said, "What do you think?" She said, "We would help him to die." So she didn't search us, but she pulled us away. She said, "Keep away," she said, "in case they might look just through the keyhole or open the door suddenly and say I wasn't doing my job." So then after she kept us there for a while, and then she opened the door and she called us, "All right," and then as we went up. So when we got into my father, he said, "Well, Lily," he said, "I suppose you know what this means." I said, "Oh, no. Oh, no, not that," he said. "Yes, Lily." She broke down then and she said, "But your beautiful life, James," she said, "your beautiful life." And he said, "Wasn't it a full life, Lily, and isn't this a good end?" And she still cried. So he says, look, Lily, please don't cry. He says, you'll unman me. So she tried to control herself. I was trying to control myself too. Then he said to me, put your hand down on the bed. So I put it down on the bed. And he said, that's a copy of my statement to the court martial. Try and get it out. So his piece of paper was folded up very tightly, not bigger than that. So I took it anyway. And we were there. So I talked about little things. He was trying to plan our life for him after he was gone. And then they told us time was up and we'd have to go. He used to be shot at dawn, you see. So, Mom, we couldn't get Mom away from the bed. The nurse had to come finally and help her away. And I went to the door, and then I went back to him. That was the last I saw him. We went back in the morning, you know, to claim his body. We thought we'd have to put in the claim anyway. Of course, they wouldn't hear of it. But Mama had asked the nurse, when she was helping her from the room, she says, get me a lock of his hair. And she did that.
They shot Sean McDermott and then Connolly by strapping him into a chair as he was unable to sit up himself, and the family were denied the right of burial. And there he goes. So due to the brutality the British showed against the Rising, national sentiment totally reverses within 2 months. And so we're told the Rising and its participants are into the pantheon that held Tone and O'Connell and Mitchell and fueled the Rising national movement, which really took off during the anti-conscription campaign in 1918, and the War of Independence starts from there. And that's it. That's Connolly.
I guess my question was, is Connolly's death a victory for British imperialism, or is it a defeat?
I think it's undoubtedly a victory, because Connolly was, you know, you think about everything that happens afterward in terms of the Civil War and the treaty, which, to just give a very, you know, short summary, the War of Independence is fought. The British enter into negotiations with the plenipotentiaries of Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins. And the settlement is that the 26-county state that we have today is the Free State, but the 6 counties will remain within the British Empire. The Irish will not have control. The Free State will not have control over its ports, obviously partition, and British landlords will continue to be compensated for lands that they are losing, which they got through colonization in the first place. The pro-treatyites sell this as you know, a victory or a stepping stone to independence, and the anti-treatyites, the Republicans, object, and they say, you know, partition is not what we fought for. We want the All-Ireland Republic. Now, sadly, they seem to be in a, well, you know, at least in terms of fighting force, they were very much in a minority, and they were unable to contend with the military force of the Free State Army, as well as, I think, the British guns that they secured from them. You know, Winston Churchill, as an interesting kind of aberration in history, considered engaging the anti-treatyites when they took up a garrison in the forecourts. But the Civil War is fought out between these pro-treaty and anti-treaty figures, and the Free State waged this campaign of terror against Republicans, very much in the mold of the war the imperialists would have waged against Irish freedom fighters in the past, in terms of suspending martial law, summary executions for prisoners, all that sort of stuff. I think, you know, because the Republicans and those who stood by the Republic declared in 1916 were defeated, but in some respects their program was also a failure, in that it didn't have that broader social element. You had figures like Patrick O'Donnell and Liam Mallows, who, the latter of whom had kind of a more of a recent turn maybe towards thinking about socialism and national liberation. Whereas Connolly is someone who, if he was on the scene, would have been at the forefront with his own independent fighting force. And I mean, I know this is just like, you know, wishful thinking or cosplaying Kaiser Reich, whatever you want to call it. But it's hard for me to look at his life before and just see how well placed he was strategically, politically, at almost every stage, to say that he wouldn't have been of benefit to the working class on an all-Ireland basis going forward if only he wasn't killed.
But listen, we are coming up to 2 hours. We should probably log off. Tell us a little bit about projects you're working on, something to suggest, further readings, any recommendations?
I will send you a few bits that maybe you can put in the episode description. You know, I have a blog, I have a Twitter account. If you want to tag me in those, that's fine. And if people want like an Irish Republican socialist reading list or filmography, I can put that together either for them, if they would like.
Carried him up to They carried him on to the jail, and there they shot him of a bright May morning, laid him in a quick light. Mourns now for our James Connolly, who mourns now for our gallant man. Oh, lay me down in yon garden, make my bearers union men. He laid him down in the green garden. Union men, each and every side, and they swore they'd forge one mighty union and fill that gallant man